Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Irina Smith, and I'm going to just go to you in a second. I asked Irina to come back last time she was here. We talked about what was in her book, The Golden Ticket. It was a life in college essays, and it was so much more complicated than I assumed. And it had two very important, strong strains of life woven together. So I asked you to come back to do the other one. We talked about what it takes to get into colleges through an essay last time. Woven into that is your life with your children. And it occurred to me, and you've got, as it happens, three children with special needs. And we were talking, and it occurred to me, of course, all children are special needs. So let's just talk about yours, because I think it would be helpful to people. Just talk about them for a minute, and maybe one, two, and three, and what you kind of expected, if anything, when you became a mother, what you thought your children would be, and when you started to notice that there are things you should be noticing.
So it would probably take more than the time that we have to tell everybody's story, but the distilled short version is that our oldest son, Jordan, was diagnosed with autism when he was 2.5, in the late 90s. And I should flag that, in order to say that in the late 90s, the sum total of knowledge about autism in at least popular culture was the film Rain Man, which had come out a few years earlier. And that was pretty much it. And so we suddenly had this diagnosis that we really didn't know what to do with. And my husband and I were 20.
What made you go to somebody for a diagnosis? You must have noticed behavior that was hard for you to deal with.
That is a great question. So, all kinds of deficits that we didn't know how to put together because he was our first child. And when we raised them to our pediatrician, she sort of dismissed us. And I think pediatricians are generally more savvy now, but he never really liked being held. He would arch away when we would hold him, where he had this trick where he would put his elbow in our neck to, sort of arch away. He didn't really develop meaningful language. He developed some language, but it was mostly repeating what he heard. And he wasn't picking up things like yes, no. So we would have these very circular conversations like, do you want a waffle? And he would say waffle. And we would say yes. And he would say yes. And we would say, do you want a waffle? And he would say waffle. And it just went on and on like that. And he didn't play with other kids. There was a lot in retrospect.
Yes, I didn't realize it was so clear.
So, and fortunately or unfortunately, or I guess both, my husband was doing his psychiatry residency at Stanford, and our concerns reached an apex right as he was doing his rotation through the Children's Health Council and their Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorders Clinic. So, it so happened that the first patient he saw as a resident was a 2.5 year old little boy who looked remarkably like our son in terms of behavior. And so we were able to get Jordan, our oldest son, diagnosed early and do a lot of early intervention, by which I mean, really breaking language down into
Okay,
smaller.
let's start a little bit more back just for people who may have maybe looking at this with their own children. And at what point, okay, when you went to the doctor or whoever you went to for the diagnosis, you had a suspicion that this was true, right? That this was the issue. And so it was not a surprise.
No, I mean it was in some ways helpful to have a name for it. But it was clear to us that something was wrong. And when my husband came home, he showed me the diagnostic criteria in the DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatry. And sure enough, we checked almost every criterion. So it wasn't a huge surprise.
What was the first thing you thought?
Oh no, or probably a stronger version of that, because I think all parents, I mean, let's be frank. I think the word reproduction comes from the desire to reproduce, right? And to create a mini you. And both my husband and I are very verbal. We talk a lot, we read a lot. And here we have this child who has zero interest in any of those things, plus zero interest in us or other children or socializing. So it feels a little bit like maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe we're being terrible parents, and that's why he doesn't.
So, as sophisticated as your husband is, and as smart and aware as you are, you still thought that?
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard not to think it. I was a little bit ameliorated by the fact that he didn't really seem to like anyone, not just us. And he wasn't, I mean, he was a happy kid. He, smiled and laughed and chortled, but it was all very insular and it wasn't really dependent on other people. And so, I think all parents fundamentally, other than to have a mini me, also want their children to be healthy and happy and ultimately independent. And that was.
That those three words we'll get back to and back to, because that is what you want: healthy,
Exactly.
happy, and independent. And those three things can be defined.
Right. Well, in all sorts of ways. But in our son's case, the happy part was there. He was a pretty happy baby. Healthy physically, yes, in terms of, sort of neurotypical development, no. And all we could see in our total panic was, oh my God, he's never going to learn to talk or take care of himself or advocate for himself. And what happens when we die?
Oh, I was going to say, so that must have felt like a huge responsibility on you.
Yep.
And your question could have been, what do I do next?
Exactly. Well, that was exactly our question because we're very problem-solving kind of people. So we essentially put ourselves through a crash course in, what to do with young children with an autism diagnosis.
And what are you
And
supposed to do? Or will you
well,
do that?
there are many schools of thought, and the one that is still sort of the first line of intervention is called applied behavioral analysis, which was started by a child psychiatrist named Ivor Lovaas at UCLA. And it essentially breaks down complex social behaviors into the most elemental units because kids who are autistic don't learn language and social behavior by osmosis.
Can you give us an example of how that works?
So it breaks down, sure, it breaks down complex behavior into something very concrete that you can immediately reinforce. And
Like
so, for
what?
example, eye contact. So Jordan, our son, really liked Cheerios. And so we had a bowl of Cheerios and you would hold them at eye level and say, look at me. And when he did, you immediately gave him a Cheerio. And eventually, it became sort of a game for him where he was like, oh, I do this thing and I get a Cheerio. And then that's also how we taught him to say yes. No was a little bit trickier because we had to find something that he didn't like. And so, it was like, would you like an olive? And he would start screaming. And then we would say no. And then eventually figured out that, if you said no, took the olive
I should
away.
be laughing, but it is.
Yeah. Well, and the remarkable thing is how quickly he, sort of figured it out. And I think in some ways it made him, I don't know if I should say happier, but it helped him navigate because he would scream a lot and lunge for things because there was no way for him to communicate what he wanted. And so,
Was it at all his feeling happy that he was somehow in charge of his own?
well, exactly. He could get his needs met. Although I will also say that we got a lot of sideways looks in restaurants because, like, we'd go to a Mexican restaurant and he would be, doing a body dive for the chip basket. And we would be like, say, chip, please. And then eventually he would say, chip, please. And all these families are like, what is wrong with those people? And it's like, we have a project. So, yeah. Anyway, so we, eventually you chain together these fairly simple behaviors into more complex behaviors. As he learned to communicate more, he became more interested in other children. And so we would have these facilitated play dates where, we were in the periphery trying to redirect him if he lost interest and wandered off or, wanted to bash somebody over the head, which Also, to be fair, normal or normally developing 3 year old kids do
Also do, yes.
all the time. And so there was this intensive full court press to kind of get in there and take advantage of the neuroplasticity that very young children have in
Oh.
order to teach him the kinds of behaviors that our hope was would stand him in good stead when we were no longer around to help him navigate the world.
You say neuroplasticity. Do you want to just define that a little bit? I mean, when they're able to, you.
Well, the brain is still developing, right? And so it also works with adults because the brain has a remarkable number of sort of backup mechanisms and redundancies. And so if somebody, for example, has a stroke or a brain injury and lose the ability to speak, you actually can, through very similar kind of repeated training, reteach some of the
Okay, I
skills.
thought you were using that, and you said, "Well, we can."
Well, because the window
Okay.
for Well, the window for a little kid is much bigger and more generous than it is for an adult who already has neural pathways cut pretty deep. So there was this very intensive, and I would say in retrospect, problem-solving oriented approach that my husband and I took, in that the autism was a problem and it was something that we needed to solve, which again, in the absence of any kind of other, more positive thinking. And I don't think we were negative or punitive about it, but it was, basically like this thing that you have is going to get in the way of your life. And so we're trying our best to mitigate it. But I think as Jordan got older, that sense of, don't do this, do this, and kind of, potentially over direction, became more problematic, especially when there were two other kids in the house
Okay,
and
I'm going to ask this because for people who you don't want to see people feel alone. So
right.
how did it get in the way of your life? And maybe this will help people who are feeling it's just me to know that it's not.
In the way of Jordan's life, you mean?
So how did it get in the way of life? You said it got in the way of
Oh, of his
your
life.
life.
And it was something that made functioning more difficult for him because he was not neurotypical, but he was a person living in a neurotypical world. And I think
I
we
didn't
have,
realize it meant his life. I'm sorry.
No, and we've evolved a lot since then. And I think people are much more informed and people make much more allowance for neurodiversity. But again, in the 90s, this was not really a dialogue that was happening. The word neurodiversity was not yet in existence. And so the way that I think both the medical community and we thought about autism was a deficit model. How do we make up for all these things that he has difficulty doing?
Instead of, you said
Instead of, I would say, maladaptive behaviors or behaviors that weren't going to stand him in good stead. Like, to give an example, one of his favorite pastimes before the diagnosis was to open and close doors. And he could do this for hours. He would stand in the kitchen with a cabinet and say, "Opie clo, opie clo, opie clo." And so that was the extent of sort of the language and the imaginative play. Or he would lie on the floor and move a toy truck in front of him and look at the wheels. And, to sort of fast forward, and we had heard these stories, there are kids with autism who are fascinated by wheels and who end up getting hurt or killed because they run out of the house so they can see the wheels on cars going by or the wheels on a train. And so, again, I can't speak for my husband, but I can for myself. I'm prone to disaster thinking. And so I was immediately, flashing forward to these are all the terrible ways that this can go down.
Right. Now, how old is he now?
He is almost 30, believe it or not.
Oh, what?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
30.
30. Okay, you don't look 30, so I'm confused. Okay.
You're very nice to say that.
All right, let's back up for me. Okay. So he's almost 30. So just take a few minutes if you would. What has his life been and what is he doing now? And
So he currently teaches physical education. He graduated from college and has a teaching
wait,
degree.
we're gonna have to back up. How did he get that far?
Through a very, very rocky road. And essentially, our house was full of angst and fighting, especially during his teenage years, because the sort of typical teenage oppositionality, together with a firestorm of hormones, together with, I'll say it, potentially somewhat overbearing parents, did not make for a happy situation. And so, fortunately, in high school, he discovered wrestling, which,
School. He got through school and he did well and he got into college.
yeah.
This is important to stress.
It is. It wasn't, right now in retrospect, it seems like, oh, he's a success story. The getting there was,
I'm sure, but the point is, you got there.
yes. No, he did. And so he lives independently. He drives. He is currently very into jujitsu, which I think is the next step for people who wrestled in high school. And now there's jujitsu studios and tournaments that he participates in. He actually dabbled a little bit in improv theater, following my husband's and my example, which he really enjoyed. So I think that he really has come through some very, very difficult challenges and setbacks.
Yeah. But this is just so fascinating, and I know it had to be difficult and wonderful. But does he look back at his own life, and is he able to say anything like from where he is now about what his life was like? And having been diagnosed with autism, obviously has not let that define him in any way.
Right.
But so what does he say or think? Do you know?
It's interesting because he has a lot of opinions and ideas, particularly about his middle school placement. That was a big bone of contention because instead of going to what would have been our home local middle school with all his elementary school friends, which didn't have any support for him at all, he ended up going to a different middle school that was also pretty much mainstream, but he had a dedicated classroom for kids with social emotional learning differences where that was basically his classroom. And at that point, he wanted more than anything to fly under the radar and to have everybody think he was quote unquote normal. And so he was adamant that he did not want to be in this room with the bleeping weirdos. And I don't think I should say the word he used on Zoom, but you can imagine. It starts with an F and
I see.
anyway, he essentially did everything for those 3 years of high school to prove that he shouldn't be there by acting out, by getting into fights, by being really, really sort of aggressive and difficult both at school and at home. And he still has very strong opinions that he shouldn't have been at that school, which I will argue socially, it was not a great fit. Academically, in terms of study skills, it really prepared him for high school. And we asked him the other day, as a teacher, where do you think would have been a better place looking back? And he really couldn't answer. He said, maybe a boarding school. And we did look at a boarding school when he was in seventh grade because things had gotten so off the rails at home. And he was totally uninterested. And the boarding school, which I think would have served him well, said, if we don't have his buy-in, it was in Northern California in the Trinity Alps. They were like, we're not going to take a kid who's going to run away into the forest potentially. So he finished out middle school at home and ended up going to our neighborhood high school. But I think to the point of the early intervention, he said multiple times and continues to say that he's grateful that we gave him a chance to have a choice between, sort of joining the neurotypical world or not. And there was one thing that I didn't mention that I should have at the beginning, which is when he was first diagnosed, the psychiatrist who diagnosed him referred him to our regional center for services because your, tax dollars go in part toward early childhood intervention or help for kids with mental or physical disabilities. And what we wanted was for him to go to a mainstream preschool with a one-to-one aide, behavioral aide, who would help facilitate interaction. And the regional center did not want to pay for that because that was expensive. What they wanted was to put him in a special school that was about half an hour from our house in Belmont, off 280. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's, kind of like this very official looking, low slung building. And they made it very appealing. It would have been completely free. A school bus would have picked him up at 7:30 in the morning and dropped him off at 5:30 or 6 p.m. We wouldn't have to do anything. And my husband and I, and he went to look at the school, and it was for pretty severely developmentally delayed kids. He was the only one who talked because at that point we had already done a lot of early intervention. He was interested in toys, and there were a lot of kids, and it broke my heart, but they literally were just like, sitting and
Right.
swaying and
Right.
looking.
Yeah,
Yeah. And so the teacher was super excited because she was like, oh my God, here comes my class valedictorian. And I'm not going to say I wasn't tempted because it would have been so easy to just park him there, not have to deal with it, not have to shadow him when the aide couldn't come to the preschool, not have to do all this work at home. And both my husband and I said, yes, it would have been easy, but he also would have just stagnated there and he wouldn't have.
wouldn't that have put him in a position of identifying with people who really were not like him?
Exactly. Well, and part of the problem, and there's been this discussion as well with, the deaf community versus the hearing community. Hearing or children of deaf parents, cochlear implant, yes or no? And there are people who feel passionately that yes, because the child should have a choice of how they want to live their life. And many people who are the deaf community advocates or in the deaf community are like, no, this is the child's culture, and you're essentially separating them from their parents. And so we made that call because our reasoning was if he has enough skills to navigate the more difficult world for him, then he can decide later how he wants to identify and what he wants to do. And so,
On that now.
yeah, so he's grateful for that.
But how does he identify?
Oh, he does not want to be autistic. He thinks he's not anymore. I don't know that anybody who met him would immediately go, wow, this man is autistic. I mean, he's socially a little bit quirky, by which I mean that he speaks social as a second language. I think it's not something that came to him
I was
naturally.
going to ask about that before when you said, will you hold up the Cheerios and look at me? That's learning to do that physically is different than doing it.
Exactly, because you're actually interested in your parents' faces. Yeah.
Okay, so I have a question now, and I've got so many thoughts. I want to write a love letter to him or to you. I'm about the power of letters and the lasting power of letters. Have you ever written a letter to him?
Yes, actually. So he, during college, this is another chapter I didn't mention, but when he was in college, he had a really, really serious bout of severe depression, and he had to take a medical leave. And during a very dark time for him and for all of us, he needed to go to wilderness therapy because just
Oh.
living in the day-to-day world was not working for anyone, and he wasn't safe. And he was there for 2 months, and then there's a once a month sort of event called parent seminar, where parents of the young adults who are in the program come to reunite with their kid. And they at the very last, on the very last day of the weekend, everybody reads a gratitude letter. And so Jordan wrote a 9-page letter to us, handwritten, which I think was a heroic feat because he, on top of everything else, has dysgraphia. So handwriting, or just writing, any printing, is challenging. And my husband and I each wrote him a letter, and then you go around in a circle and read the letters out loud. And I think it was, I'm not exaggerating when I say that it was one of the most meaningful and moving moments
I'm
of all
sure.
of our lives.
Well, then I have another question. So you've done letters to each other. Obviously, you still have his letter.
Yes.
You still have yours, do you know?
I imagine yes. I don't know if he took it with him. I think he might not have because they were out in wilderness, and so I think we kept our hard copies.
Oh,
And he
good.
asked,
Good.
yeah, he asked for it later when he.
I have another suggestion that
Sure.
I think is thrills me. Have you ever written one to yourself?
No.
Can I ask you to do that?
Yes.
Dear Irina, and then I'm writing this to you, and then really, I don't like to put words in people's mouth, and I shouldn't be the love letter police, but along the line of just to say how much I admire what you did, whatever this whole thing that you just said talked about in paper to yourself. And sign it however you want. You put it in an envelope, you mail it to yourself with a stamp. And when you get that letter, my experience from what I is the you who wrote the letter and the you who will now read it are two different people. And you will have something forever. And I kind of look down the long path that you said, what's going to happen to him once I'm gone? And apparently he's going to be okay, but he's also going to find this letter. People find letters in, you keep it in some, stick it in a book or a, wherever you put little treasures. And it's going to be an extra legacy gift to him. And by the way, to your other children as well. Well, I want to thank you for doing this with me. You are remarkable. And
Thank you.
I want to say again, for anybody who has not read your book, the goal, your writing is so glorious. Your
Thank
writing
you.
is so wonderful. That's all.
Thank you, Janet.
Remarkable. You are clear. You are adorable. You are funny. You are just everything really great. And that you have a child that old is going to confuse me for the rest of the
Oh,
day.
I know. I still can't believe it because I think of myself as perpetually 17, so it's incredibly confusing.
Yes. And you also look at, okay, goodbye, dear. Thank you so much for doing
Thank
that.
you. It was really nice to talk to you.
Thank you. And what I want to say is that, yes, we're going to say goodbye. And thank you again for doing this with me. And I hope that we get to see each other in some other. I just love the story of your family.
Thank you.
It's just so uplifting and instructive.
Thank
Thank
you
you.
so much.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.